Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. I'm Lauren Corman here with Carl Orzechowski, teching for us today and bringing us the news.
Hello.
I wanted to share something with our listeners before we get started with the news and the interview today with Will Tuttle. We're talking with him about a book called The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. But I wasn't here last week because we had some very sad news about Mark Karbusiski passing along. And for people who are familiar with the show, you might know Mark from teching the program for a number of years, both with his partner Mia Saleh Ross and with me and Najda as well for a number of years. And he is no longer with us. And we're hoping to do some kind of show that commemorates him in some way. So if you have ideas about what that would look like, or if you have a particular story about how Mark touched your life, especially in regards to animals, you can write us. We would love to incorporate some of those stories into our commemoration show. And our email address is animalvoices@gmail.com. Again, that's animalvoices@gmail.com. And actually, I was thinking, Carl, as we were playing the intro, that Mark did that intro for us.
Oh, really?
Yep. So that's his, it's his handiwork.
Wow.
Yeah, so his fingerprints are all over the show. There's pictures of Mark on our website, animalvoices.ca. If you're interested in refamiliarizing yourself with his face, he was an incredible support to this program for a number of years, did an amazing job as a tech, was very reassuring and supportive and just a great inspiration, and also helped organize the show for a number of years with Mira Soleil Ross. He wasn't just the tech. So, without further ado, with that sad news, we'll go to you, Carl.
Okay, so first we're going to do some news. This is coming from the CBC website by way of the Associated Press. The headline is Monkey See, Monkey Sue, and this was, oddly enough, in their oddities section. In some ways, Heasel is like any other Viennese. He indulges a weakness for pastry, likes to paint, and enjoys chilling out watching TV. But he doesn't care for coffee, and he isn't actually a person, at least not yet. Austrian animal rights advocates are waging an unusual court battle to get the chimpanzee legally declared a person. Heasel's supporters argue that he needs the status to become a legal entity who can receive donations and get a guardian to look out for his interests. In a case that could set a global legal precedent for granting basic rights to apes, animal rights advocates are seeking to get the 26-year-old male chimpanzee legally declared a person. Heasel's supporters argue that he needs the status to become a legal entity so that he can receive donations. Our main argument is that Heasel is a person and has basic legal rights, said Eberhard Theuer, a lawyer leading the challenge on behalf of the Association Against Animal Factories, a Vienna animal rights group. We mean the right to life, the right not to be tortured, the right to freedom under certain conditions. We're not talking about the right to vote here. The campaign began after the animal sanctuary where Heasel and another chimp, Rosie, have lived for 25 years went bankrupt. Activists want to ensure the apes don't wind up homeless if the shelter closes. Both have already suffered. They were captured as babies in Sierra Leone in 1982 and smuggled in a crate to Austria for use in pharmaceutical experiments. Customs officers intercepted the shipment and turned the chimps over to the shelter. Their food and vet bills run about $7,500 Canadian a month. Donors have offered to help, but there's a catch. Under Austrian law, only a person can receive personal donations. Organizers could set up a foundation to collect cash for Heasel, whose life expectancy in captivity is about 60 years, but without basic rights, they contend, he could be sold to someone outside Austria where the chimp is protected by strict animal cruelty laws. If we can get Heasel declared a person, he would have the right to own property. Then, if people wanted to donate something to him, he'd have the right to receive it, said Theuer, who has vowed to take the case to the European Court of Human Rights if necessary. Austria isn't the only country where primate rights are being debated. Spain's parliament is considering a bill that would endorse the Great Ape Project, a Seattle-based international initiative to extend fundamental moral and legal protections to apes. If Heasel gets a guardian, it will be the first time the species barrier will have been crossed for legal personhood, says Jan Creamer, chief executive of Animal Defenders International, which is working to end the use of primates in research. Paula Stibbe, a Briton who teaches English in Vienna, petitioned a district court to be Hiesel's legal trustee. On April 24th, Judge Barbara Bart rejected her request, ruling Hiesel didn't meet two key tests. He is neither mentally impaired nor in an emergency. Although Bart expressed concern that awarding Hiesel a guardian could create the impression that animals enjoy the same legal status as humans, she didn't rule that he could never be considered a person. Martin Balak, who heads the Association Against Animal Factories and who coincidentally has been interviewed on this show, has asked a federal court for a ruling on the guardianship issue. Quote, chimps share 99.4% of their DNA with humans, he said. Okay, they're not Homo sapiens, but they're obviously also not things. The only other option the law provides. Not all Austrian animal rights activists back the legal challenge. Michael Antolini, president of the local Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, says he thinks it's absurd. I'm not about to make myself look like a fool by getting involved, said Antolini, who worries that chimpanzees could gain broader rights, such as copyright protections on their photographs. But Stibbe, who brings Hiesel sweets and yogurt, watches him draw and clown around by dressing up in knee-high rubber boots, insists he deserves more legal rights than bricks or apples or potatoes. He can be very playful, but also thoughtful, she said. Being with him is like playing with someone who can't talk. Another story from CBC News. U.S. holds 20 million chickens because of melamine-tainted feed. U.S. officials are conducting a risk assessment to determine if millions of chickens are safe for human consumption after discovering their feed was contaminated. The evaluation, drafted by the U.S. Agricultural Department and the Food and Drug Administration and the Environmental Protection Agency, could be completed as early as Monday. On Friday, the FDA held back 20 million chickens from going to market because their feed contained melamine, a chemical used to make plastics and fertilizers. Melamine found in tainted pet food has been blamed for the deaths of 16 cats and dogs, according to the FDA, which has also fielded about 17,000 consumer calls about related pet illnesses. Officials traced the problem to imported rice gluten and wheat protein used in the pet food. More than 100 brands of pet food have been withdrawn from the marketplace since March 16th. Canada's food inspectors have issued border lookouts for vegetable proteins coming from China to prevent melamine from contaminating the human food chain. The FDA says that chickens raised at larger plants were not likely given the tainted feed, but they said that about 5% of the feed used at smaller production facilities may have been contaminated. The U.S. agency is also holding back from market hogs from farms in six states that had received tainted pet food for use as feed. And finally, a story from the Canadian Press that was put out on May 6th. PETA to accompany Inuit on seal hunt. One of the world's most vehement animal rights organizations has accepted an invitation to go seal hunting in Nunavut. But the woman who asked People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals to come to the Arctic says she'll be wary of her future guests. This could have a serious impact, and I'm not taking it lightly, said Elisape Shutiapik, mayor of the territorial capital of Iqaluit. The invitation came after PETA wrote a letter to Iqaluit's town council, asking it to lower the flags outside its offices to half-mast to protest the Newfoundland seal hunt. I had to chuckle, said Shutiapik. I couldn't believe they sent it to us, and the council had the same reaction. At the council's behest, she responded with a letter saying, Inuit support the Newfoundland hunt, and added an invitation for PETA representatives to come to Iqaluit, join a group of Inuit seal hunters, and see how the animals are both harvested and used in Nunavut. We're happy to be able to meet with the Inuit and hear what they have to say, said PETA spokesman Matt Rice from Virginia. Rice said PETA draws a distinction between commercial seal hunts, such as those off Newfoundland, and Aboriginal subsistence hunts. But that distinction ends as soon as the hunter sells the skin instead of making a pair of kamiks out of it. Any Inuit who are participating in the sale on the international market have abandoned their traditional practice, he says. Bosh, says Shutiapik, whose own childhood was so traditional, she grew up playing games with seal knuckle bones. Sometimes they have to sell the skins, she said. That's part of their income. Rice said PETA believes that Canadian governments should redirect the money spent to encourage hunting into promotion of such things as ecotourism. Shutiapik acknowledges that some Inuit are nervous about PETA's visit, details of which are still being arranged. She says many remember a similar invitation accepted by Greenpeace during the 1970s, which the organization used to spread bloody images of seal hunting around the world. That campaign destroyed sealskin markets for a generation, impoverishing many Inuit hunters. Now that prices are recovering, some fear giving anti-sealers fresh visual fodder. There are some people concerned about this visit because of the past experience with Greenpeace, she said. The ground rules for the visit are still being worked out with the local hunters and territorial government. We're going to have conditions, I would imagine. We know very well that if they take pictures, for sure there's going to be blood. Rice said the Aboriginal hunt is being used as a cover by the Newfoundland hunters who use only the seal skins. The Inuit are being used as pawns by the Canadian government, he said. Both Rice and Shutiapik say that although minds are unlikely to change as a result of the visit, it's still worthwhile. We're coming in good faith, said Rice. We'll take any information we get from that. First-hand facts are always worth having, said Shutiapik. I have to try to do my bit to educate these people. And that's the news.
Great, thanks, Carl. You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and speak with Dr. Will Tuttle. He's the author of a new book from Lantern called The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. And for anybody who thinks this isn't a hard-hitting book, you're going to be surprised. It's a pretty radical text. Lots of interesting things Will is saying. It will be interesting to speak with him in the next couple of minutes. Please stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to the program. We should let people know who are listening to the show. And if you're interested in hearing any of the programs, either today's programs or past Animal Voices show, you can go to our website and you can access the archives there. Our website is animalvoices.ca. We have over 190 programs that you can download for free. Should also let people know that next week we're going to be speaking with John Sanbon Matsu. We'll be talking about critical theory and animal liberation. It'll be a great program. So definitely stick around next week for that as well. On today's program, we're speaking with Dr. Will Tuttle. He's the author of a new book called The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. And it says here on the back of the book that Will Tuttle has a master's degree in humanities from San Francisco State University and a PhD in the philosophy of education from the University of California, Berkeley. And he is trained as in Korea as a Zen Buddhist monk and has worked extensively in Tai Chi, yoga, meditation, intuition development, and spiritual healing. It's a pleasure to have him on the program. Thank you, Will, for being here today.
Great. Thank you, Lauren. Good to be here.
So when we interviewed Jim Mason a while ago about his new book with Peter Singer, The Way We Eat, I asked him what he had for breakfast, and I want to hear what you had for breakfast, too, if you've eaten anything today.
We usually have a smoothie for breakfast. My wife, Madeline, makes every morning, typically, or sometimes I make it, but it's basically pretty much fruits and flax seeds and almonds mixed together, and that's what gives us our energy for the morning.
Yeah, that's a lot of energy.
Yeah.
I love the story that it's mentioned on the back of the book as well as talked about more extensively in The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony, where you talk about eating an apple, and I thought that might be a good entry point into discussion about the book. Can you tell us about what it means for you and how you think about eating an apple?
Well, yeah, I talked about that in the beginning of the book, the idea that when we look deeply into our connection with nature, we see that really our most intimate and ongoing connection is through food, is through eating, and that religions from the world have recognized this, and that's why sacred feasts and festivals are always part of the spiritual life of cultures everywhere, and that if we look deeply into ourselves, we see that not only are our bodies built by the foods that we eat, but that the practices surrounding food are extremely profound in cultivating our consciousness. Our actual consciousness is molded in many ways by the food that we eat. So that if we look deeply into ourselves and our culture, we find that at the very core, in many ways, of our culture's way of living and its worldview is its practice of food, but we don't really typically see that food has this dual nature, that on the one hand it's symbolic of everything that's, you know, wonderful, nurturing, loving, you know, there's nothing more profoundly satisfying, I think, in many ways, for us as physical beings than to eat, how necessary that is. And yet, when we are forced to kill to eat, food becomes symbolic also of, not only in that, especially in our culture, of cruelty, of death, and of really in our culture, especially today, of unnecessary cruelty and death. So it has this dark side as well, and this is the, I think, the dilemma at the heart of our culture that has been covered over for a long time, and it's getting, in many ways, harder and harder to cover over as we raise our consciousness. It becomes more and more, I think, a realization that it's not appropriate for us or for the earth to be killing animals for food.
There's a couple of quotes here that I wanted to read and that maybe you could reflect on, because I think that they get at least one of the central main themes of the book, which you're already touching upon. And this is from the first chapter called Food's Power. You say here, the desensitizing of millions of children and adults on the massive scale that consuming millions of tortured animals daily requires sows countless seeds of human violence, war, poverty, and despair. These outcomes are unavoidable, for we can never reap joy, peace, and freedom for ourselves while sowing the seeds of harming and enslaving others. We may speak of love, kindness, freedom, and a gentler world, yet it is our actions, especially those that are habitually practiced, that determine what future outcomes we and others will experience. The cycles of violence that have terrorized people both historically and today are rooted in the violence of our daily meals. Though animals cannot retaliate like other people can, our violence towards them retaliates against us. That's a pretty big claim.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's that big of a claim in the sense that it's not original with me. I think it's something that we human beings understand at a deep level. The old saying, as we sow, so shall we reap, or whatever seeds we sow in our actions will basically boomerang and come back to us. And so the reason I think you would say it's a big claim, and many people would think it's a big claim, is simply that it's largely ignored. You know, we are very naive in our culture, and I think it's an enforced state of being naive where we think that, and we just assume that somehow it's allowed to us to kill animals for food, that God didn't give them a soul, and we would die if we didn't eat their protein, and he just put them here for us to use, and, you know, all these stories we hear. And so we think that there's no repercussions, and yet we're forcing literally armies, huge armies of our brothers and sisters to work in slaughterhouses and factory farms and places where animals are killed, and to daily do the horrible work that I don't think any of us would want to do, and plus force the animals to go through this incredible suffering that they go through, both chronically and acutely, and the fear that they go through, and the terror. And these things obviously are creating enormous seeds of planting, you know, planting very powerful seeds that do sprout and grow in our culture as disconnectedness and violence and disease. I think in the book, in chapter 3, I talk about how if you look at any of the problems that we have as a culture that we're trying to deal with, you will see, we can see that we every one of those problems we are inflicting on animals first. And I give a whole litany of them, but, you know, like toxic environments that we're, you know, we're worried about that. Our own environment's becoming more and more toxic, and we see how we force animals to live in more toxic environments, extremely toxic environments. How the breakdown of the family, and how we force animals to have no family, or obesity, how they're sold by the pound, or drug use, how they're just drugged enormously, or teenage pregnancy. You know, these animals are all forced to be impregnated when they're, you know, way beyond they ever would in the wild. And, you know, war, terrorism, all of the things that we experience as being serious problems that we're trying to deal with that are devastating our culture, we are inflicting on animals. So it's clear, if we just open our eyes and look, we can see it. The thing is, we've been trained by our culture not to see and not to make these connections. And I think as long as we don't make those connections, we are condemned. Like if you look at the Greek plays of antiquity, you know, the tragic hero always fell at the end because he couldn't make the connection. He couldn't see. He didn't understand what he was doing, and he had an enormous arrogance that didn't allow him. He thought he was somehow better than nature. And we are basically, I think, in many ways in the same position, and unless we awaken this capacity that we all have spiritually to make connections and soften our hearts so that we act with compassion for animals, we'll continue to just reap what we're sowing in regards to our actions to animals that are just routine every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that was, I thought, something a really powerful insight in the book about that sort of habitual practice.
Right.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about the root, because there's the argument, and I think you're alluding to this, that other people have made this argument
right
before, but it's often not picked up, and it's certainly not widespread, that the creating or perpetuating harm against animals, you know, sets the groundwork for doing that to the rest of the environment, to other people.
Right.
I think other people would start at a different place, though, in terms of looking at the roots of violence. Some people might start with patriarchy. Some people might start with a class
right
analysis. How do you respond to those people who would say, no, you know, you're starting at the wrong place? How can you say this is the root? These relationships with animals and this commodification of animals and these habitual practices of eating animals is at the root of all these other manifestations of violence in our culture.
For one reason, just look at what's the most taboo thing to talk about. You know, it's not taboo to talk about patriarchy. It's very taboo to talk about what we're talking about. People will do almost anything to change the subject. It's very interesting. People get very nervous. They get very antagonistic, or they just want to leave. It's something that everyone's engaging in. You know, we can talk about patriarchy. Everything is kind of theoretical. You know, it's kind of theoretical. Oh yeah, there's patriarchy, or people aren't spiritually evolved, or you know, whatever different things people say. It's not something that they're actually engaging in 3 times a day, where they're actually taking out their wallet and buying the food and eating it. And this is where I think we can really see it. This is an action. Our daily meals are actions that have enormous effects on us and on our world. And they not only build the body, speech, and mind that we use to function in the world, but the underlying violence tends to perpetuate itself. And so the necessity I think we have is to understand that, and also to just look historically at how our culture evolved as well. I like to kind of emphasize that. I have a couple of chapters on how when herding of animals began, our consciousness was changed by that a lot, I think. And there's a lot of researchers that have talked about this, but I don't think people usually pick up on it. But there's this strong sense, I think, it's hard to know exactly what happened, even in history, much less in prehistory, because we're talking about going back 8 to 10,000 years. But basically, when people started herding animals for food, it required a different mindset. And what I argue in the book is that that was the last great revolution in human consciousness, was the herding of animals for food. And we're still basically in that mindset. It's very telling, for example, that the very first word for war, according to linguists in the world, was the old Sanskrit word gavya. And literally, gavya means the desire for more cattle. So war itself is linked as far back as we can go to herding cattle. And I discussed that quite a bit. I don't know if we have time, you know, this morning to talk about all that. But briefly, when people started herding animals for food, our whole view towards nature changed. Instead of being an animal, too, instead of seeing animals as mysterious cohabitants of this magical, mysterious world, they became reduced to mere property. And it's this action of reducing, this mental action of reducing, that I think is the key to understand. Once we reduced animals, and they were the that was really the primary action, to mere property, and whoever had the most animals had the most wealth. And over many, many centuries, millennia it took, for this to happen, that we created the first capitalist system. Capita coming from head, meaning how many head of cattle and sheep and goats you had determined how much wealth you had. And these first wealthy capitalists that had the most animals were able to employ many soldiers to fight and try to steal other people's cattle and land and water to feed those animals. And that became the way to get rich back then. And so this reducing of animals and consequent reducing of land and of nature and of wild animals to mere pests that would, possibly harm the cattle, and then of women. At the same time, women became chattel property. It was around 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, and the first human slavery arose at the same time. Shortly after that, within the centuries and millennia following that. And so, by the time the historic period really begins, around 4,000 years ago, you can see it very clearly. It's well established in the Old Testament writings, in the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Epic of Gilgamesh. The first writings in our culture. You can see it's well established where men own land, own cattle, own women, and the wealthy elite is ruling everyone, and people are going to war and killing each other in order to increase the wealth of this elite. And this system spread to Europe, and it spread to this culture, and it's spreading around the world still through McDonald's and through Walmart and through ConAgra and Cargill and all these corporations, and it's still the same basic system. And the revolutions that we've talked about since then, like the Industrial Revolution and so forth, have not been revolutions at all. They've just reinforced the same basic mentality, which is a mentality of reducing beings to things, beings to commodities. And until we question that, I don't think there's any way to solve the underlying problems of our culture, of environmental devastation, of inequality, of exploitation and oppression of others. All these things, the lack of freedom, disease, and all these things, really, I think, come primarily from this mentality of reducing and of excluding. It's really a mentality of privilege, that there's, we're privileged as opposed to the animals, and so we can just use them, and so we exclude them from the sphere of our concern and compassion. And it's a short step from that to excluding other human beings, and then we all become basically commodities, and we live in a system where we have to commodify ourselves, sell ourselves on the market, manipulate ourselves and others, and compete with each other in a really very competitive system that's based fundamentally, if we really look at it, I think, on violence and exploitation of whoever's vulnerable. And as long as we eat that way, eat as predators, we'll create a system like that. We've been indoctrinated into it, we've been born into it, and we've been forced into it, but it's not, I don't believe, it's not our true nature. Our true nature is compassion and kindness, and so that's why we're so uncomfortable with what we're doing, and why we just numb ourselves and don't want to talk about it, and don't want to think about it, and it's taboo to talk about, because we know it isn't right. And I think we know at a deep level that the seeds that we're sowing do come back and harm us. And until we are able to face this, I think all our efforts at world peace and freedom and environmental sustainability and so forth are merely ironic, and they will be looked at in the future as ironic. How, oh yeah, those people wanted peace and harmony, but they wanted to be able to stab animals indiscriminately. For what reason? We don't need their protein. We don't need anything we need nutritionally we can get from plants. So once we understand these things, we realize that we can be the greatest force for healing, for peace, for loving kindness, compassion, freedom in the world by granting these things to the beings that we're taking them from. We're stealing freedom and life and happiness and harmony from these animals, and yet we want to have it for ourselves. And we know that all the traditions of the world, all the wisdom traditions have said that what we would most want for ourselves, we're called to give to others. So if I want, you know, happiness and harmony for myself, but I'm going to be causing others to be living in fear and terror and misery, then it'll never work. It won't happen for us. And as a culture, we pretend that we don't understand this when it comes to animals, like they don't matter. Just like we did with black people maybe 150 years ago, like it doesn't matter. You know, God put them here for us to use. But we know now, we've evolved somewhat, that that's not true. And I think the next step is to evolve to see that all living beings have interests, and it is up to us to help protect their interests, that we are all in this together, and that the welfare of all living beings is interconnected, that we are all interconnected, and that this fundamental wisdom is shattered in us as children, growing up in a system where we're forced by our parents and by our culture to view animals merely as commodities to be used. That's the basic understanding that I think we're yearning at a deep level to attain. And there's nothing more wonderful, I don't think, than someone attaining this understanding. It's not easy to do, and actually living a vegan life and understanding why they're doing it for the reasons that the word vegan was invented by Donald Watson, reasons of compassion for all life.
We're going to take a short break. I want to come back and talk a little bit more about spirituality, the ripples of what we do to animals, and what kind of unique contribution this book in particular makes to that discussion. So we'll come back with you. Today we're speaking about Dr. Will Tuttle's new book, The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Today we're speaking with Dr. Will Tuttle about his new book, The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. Welcome back to the program, Will.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So there's a lot of books out there that talk about our terrible treatment of animals within various different animal exploiting industries, the animal industrial complex, I think Barbara Noske calls it. And there's a lot of food books out there right now. I mean, Jim Mason's book, The Way We Eat with Peter Singer, as well as the Omnivore's Dilemma, Michael Pollan, just to mention a couple. But your book is doing something a bit different than those, and I was wondering if you could talk about how you see your book as unique and what part of the conversation in particular you feel that you're contributing to, and I'm hoping that you'll pick up that thread about spirituality a bit more.
I actually kept thinking that someone would write a book that would give the big picture about what we do, not only our treatment of animals for food, and there's, you know, there's sort of the usual three things people talk about, the health, you know, effects of eating animal food on us, which are very often deleterious health effects, and the environmental, also deleterious environmental effects, and also how the animals suffer. But there's so much more. There's such a much bigger picture when we begin to look at the psychology involved, sociology, and the anthropology, the history of all of this. And then beyond that, the spiritual dimension, the metaphysical dimension. And I kept thinking, boy, it'll be great to read this book when it comes out. I'm sure someone will write this book. I mean, it's, you know, pretty clear that this is part of a much larger picture to understand our whole culture. And as the years went by and no one wrote it, I finally realized that this was my book to write. So I spent 5 years just working on this book. And I had already, you know, probably been a vegan for maybe 20 years at that point, and when I was 25, and immersed myself in trying to make these connections. And for me, my whole reason, I guess, for becoming vegan originally back in my early 20s was for spiritual reasons, I guess. I ended up living at the farm in Tennessee for about a month and a half or so, which was the largest hippie, long-haired commune in the world back in 1975 when I found it. And it was all vegan. And it was people living, about like almost 1,000 people at that point. We didn't use the word vegan because no one even knew that word back then. But it was basically no animal foods. And I remember walking with this guy, and he said, yeah, I even have vegetarian shoes. And it kind of blew my mind. Wow, I mean, you don't even wear leather either. And it was all for creating a more harmonious world, with the idea to live more in harmony with the earth, with the animals, with each other, and not exploit other living beings. And I was born and raised in Concord, Massachusetts, and I found out later that the first vegan community in the United States actually was in Concord, right outside Concord, Fruitland, Bronson Alcott's place. Emerson gave some money. He never lived there, but Bronson Alcott and Louisa May, his daughter and other, his family and other people, lived a life of eating no animal foods and not even wearing, using any cotton, because that was back in 1850. That was still from, you know, the slave states in the southern part of the United States. So they were wearing shoes of linen and walking through the snowdrifts, and they were really, really hardcore vegans back then. And maybe I picked up on some of that as a little kid, you know, walking around in the town somehow. But I also, when I went to Korea and lived as a Zen monk with a shaved head and took a different name and meditated in the morning, starting at 3 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock at night, and I realized after I was there for a little while that this was a community, a spiritual community, that had been vegan for 650 years. It was a very powerful experience to be in a community of people who had a very rich meditation, spiritual life, and who consciously would eat no animal flesh, milk, dairy products, eggs, or wear any silk, wool, or leather, and really not even kill mosquitoes. I mean, we really lived in a life of trying to minimize the suffering we cause to animals. And I think when we're making an effort to calm the mind and go to a deeper place spiritually, that it becomes more and more obvious that this is necessary. We live in an extremely busy, fast, externally oriented culture, and I think that's one of the reasons our culture is like that, is because we don't want to slow down and really pay attention to the reality that's on our plate, the realities that we're engaged in our daily life. And I think spirituality in many ways is mindfulness. It's becoming more mindful and more aware of the ripples that radiate from my life and how I am interconnected with the rest of the world, with the whole created order. And so we have to break these connections in our mind to live in this culture in many ways, and learn the art of being unmindful. You know, basically, we learn to disconnect. We learn to be numb to the results of our actions. And spirituality, I think, in many ways, is the effort to go in the opposite direction, to become more mindful, more sensitive, more aware, to take off the layers of armor that we've put on, and to really feel our interconnectedness with all life, and to become sensitive to the suffering of others, and to become sensitive of how my life affects others. And as we do that, it becomes very obvious, I think very quickly, that the greatest suffering that animals experience, and we all know that they are totally capable, just like we are, of experiencing suffering, is from our meals. That literally scores of billions of animals in the United States and North America alone are killed every year for food. It's this incredible, millions and millions of animals a day are slaughtered. So if any one of us wants to make a direct contribution, this is such, to me, terrific news, such amazingly positive news. We can directly start saving other living beings by making different choices, and eating a plant-based diet for ethical reasons creates not only ripples that go out into the world that are harmonious and bless others, but also changes our whole body and mind. And mm-hmm. So I think the contribution of the World Peace Diet really is to, first of all, cast for the first time really in our culture, cast this whole idea of what veganism is and living a lifestyle where we eat a plant-based diet in its bigger view, in the largest view possible, and to see the psychological and sociological ramifications of this, and the spiritual ramifications, and how liberating it is spiritually. Mm. And then also that we are called to live this in our lives, to really, if we're vegans, to really live this with regard to everyone, you know, animals and humans, to never exclude anyone from the sphere of our compassion. That really the vegan movement, I think, is the ultimate human rights and spiritual enlightenment movement all rolled into one, that as we strive to be what the word vegan points at, which is to live a life of inclusiveness of everyone in the sphere of our compassion, then we naturally become agents of healing and peace. And I think this has been missing, really, in many ways, in the animal rights community, and it's certainly been missing in the general, you know, overall mass culture. And it was interesting, the person who coined the word vegan, his name was Donald Watson, in 1944, coined the word vegan and said, "Veganism is a philosophy and way of life which seeks to exclude as far as possible and practical all unnecessary forms of cruelty to animals for food, clothing, or any other purpose." He coined the word to, it's really an ancient idea, but to bring into our language this idea in one word, to live a life of kindness and compassion for animals, for the benefit of humans, animals, and the environment, for the benefit of all living beings. And my friend Joe Connolly, who's the editor of Veg News, was visiting Donald Watson about a year and a half ago. My book had just come out, and I had sent Donald Watson a copy of my book, and Joe was there. And Donald was 92 years old, I think, or 93. He was just on his deathbed, actually. He was just getting ready to leave the world. And Joe reported back to me. He said the only thing he wanted to do was have my book read to him. And he said, Finally, someone has got this, and he can pass on. And so I really feel, in a sense, the responsibility to carry that the World Peace Diet, the book that I wrote, in a sense, captured the essence of what he was trying to bring into Western culture. The idea that what veganism is not just something for health or for purification or for rebellion or anything like that. It's a very profound spiritual awakening, really, is required to live this, because the forces in our culture are so mighty in the opposite direction. We're basically pressured from the time we're born to be competitive and to see beings as things and objects to be used. So to actually make a commitment to be a vegan, to include all living beings in the sphere of our compassion, is the greatest, thing anyone can do to bring peace into our world and to be an agent and a force for peace and kindness and non-exploitation and benevolence. And I talk quite a bit in the book about Sophia, the wisdom of the feminine, which was killed out, I think, in many ways by the herding culture as it began in the last revolution, 8 to 10,000 years ago, and how this feminine power within all of us, the wisdom of the interconnectedness of all life, is yearning to be reborn. We can see it all around us in the interest, for example, in Mary Magdalene and all these different things. I think we know at a deep archetypal level, spiritually, that this is our true nature, and if we don't reawaken this feminine power of the wisdom of the interconnectedness of all life and the yearning to protect and include all life, then our technology is so powerful we can easily decimate not only each other, but many, many, many of the life forms, which we're already doing, actually.
Well, I wanted to ask you about, because at the end of the book, and as a motif throughout as well, but particularly at the end, you talk about intuition. And I wanted to throw out some ideas and see if you could respond to them about the slow food movement, family farming, the 100-mile diet, small-scale animal husbandry, that some people might say, well, I feel connected with the food that I'm eating. It's not all plant-based. You know, I have a small-scale chicken farm. I treat my chickens well. I'm only eating within 100 miles of my home. I'm supporting a local farmer, for example, who is using, feed that's locally produced. How do you respond to people who might say, I have a different version of intuition? This connects me to the world. I make different connections. I have a different version of what a peace diet would look like.
Right. Well, I think these are all, in a sense, they're movements in a good direction, towards more conscious eating, more consciousness, bringing more consciousness to what we're eating, and making the connection more clearly between the reality that's on our plate and the reality that it took to get it on our plate. So I certainly think that, that those are steps in the right direction. But I really obviously feel very strongly that as long as we're slaughtering animals, you know, we are killing them. We are basically maintaining and furthering a mentality of domination, violence, commodification, exploitation of other living beings, seeing beings as merely as an end to myself. And that violence will pollute our mental atmosphere and will destroy the possibilities, really, for deeper harmony and peace, spiritual peace. So even if people, you know, have a small-scale chicken farm and they kill their chickens, you know, humanely, I mean, we would be outraged if someone was doing that with dogs, right? If you had a dog farm and were killing dogs, you know, humanely, or if they, you know, did it to humans or something, you know, we would be outraged. And these, it's like we have to make these animals into, we have to basically just deny them their yearning and right to live their lives as they were born and raised to live them, which is actually in, as jungle, like chickens, in the case of chickens, jungle fowl in Southeast Asia. And we don't need animal protein, you know, for our sustenance. We, you know, grains, beans, vegetables, fruits, nuts, and so forth provide everything that we need without forcing us to be predators. And if I'm raising animals for food, I have to be a predator. I have to stab them. And really, for example, in Buddhism, the bodhisattva ideal, which is really the ideal, I think, at the heart of all religious traditions, and I think it's really the ideal in our own true nature, which is to love and protect and care for other living beings, we have to kill that out. We have to kill that out in order to use these animals. Like if I want to have a fish farm or have chickens, or if I want to have grass-fed beef or whatever, you know, the animals aren't going to just one day lay down and say, okay, you know, take my body, I'm just ready to go. I know that since you're a human and I'm only an animal here, then it would be an honor to be eaten by you, or you know, something like that. You know, that's really not how it is, and we don't need to eat them. I think we can see that the benevolent source of all life gave us the gift of bodies that don't require any animal to suffer for their feeding. And we don't need cholesterol or animal protein. In fact, all the nutrition studies show that these are bad for us, actually. So we take this gift and we throw it back in the face of the Creator and say, anyway, I'm going to do it. I'm going to eat these animals. I like how they taste, you know, and we can live without them. So I think especially today, you know, we can go into grocery stores and we can get food that doesn't require these animals to be seen merely as objects to be used.
One of the things, too, is that you talk about, and you mentioned this at the beginning of the program, this reluctance to look, this willingness to look away. And I always think it's interesting when activists, authors, etc., talk about what our culture, broadly conceived in terms of Western dominant culture anyway, what they're not willing to look at. And I wonder, from your position, if people don't want to look at this stuff, how do you convince them that it's worthwhile to look at? It makes people uncomfortable. It might make them feel anxious. It might make them feel defensive. Where's the opportunity for opening up? Clearly, you're a hopeful person. You wrote this book, but why? Why would people look? Do you feel like you're banging your head against a wall?
Why would people look? That's such a good question. You know, I think it's in our very nature to want to look. There's a quote I have in the book. I don't know if I can turn to it, but it's something by Emerson. He says, "People wish to be settled. Only to the degree that they're willing to be unsettled is there any hope for them." And I think that kind of sums it up. I mean, on one level, we yearn to just have, no, just don't bother me with this. I have enough problems. Don't tell me about what the animals are going through. Oh, gosh, I can hardly make enough money to even buy, you know. And people sort of kind of feel overwhelmed. And then, and yet, I think we all know that we're here on this planet for a reason. We have a purpose. We have a spiritual purpose. And that if we're fulfilling that, we feel fulfilled. If we are not fulfilling it, we feel frustrated. And so I think the whole way to, I guess, to connect with people is to just bring this spiritual dimension into it. I bring it in because, first of all, I think it's important if we are vegans to connect as deeply as we can with our spiritual nature. And I think that means connecting with the deep joy that is in our hearts and to appreciate the beauty of this earth, appreciate ourselves and the opportunity we have in this life, and to be happy. And no one is going to want to be a vegan if vegans go around being bitter and critical and cynical and saying what a horrible world and everybody's screwed up and they're eating all these animals and that. You know, nobody's going to want to ever be like that. And I think, honestly, for me, becoming a vegan has been for sure the best decision I ever made in my life way back when I was, you know, like 30 years ago. And it's something to rejoice in, and to I can look out the window right here and see these beautiful leaves of this little bush and feel the love of the universe that's pouring through everything continuously. And if we can remember that and deepen our connection with that, then we can include everyone in the sphere of our compassion and not judge anyone. I don't think really no one would eat drink milk, for example, or you know, if they weren't forced by their culture to do it. No one would on their own, I don't think, go out and take a cow down and try to start suckling on her nipples. And so, I mean, it's something that we're just forced into. So to really understand that and not blame people, because you know, people, even you know, whoever it is, whatever they're doing, they were forced into it by their culture and by the institutions in the culture that are set up, that gradually evolved to do this, you know, over time. So to appeal, I guess, is what I'm saying, to the highest in people, to be understanding, to not be judgmental of them, and to say, you know, I understand, I've been there, and you know, people are afraid that they're going to, by going vegan, it's like I'm going to lose something. I'm not going to have those nice flavors that I had, or I'm not going to have that old familiar smell of my mother's kitchen with the roast beef baking in the oven, or you know, whatever it is, and to realize that you're not giving up anything. You're giving up shoes that are too tight and hurt a lot. Take them off and it's the greatest thing. You know, it's like life becomes full of much more joy. I think I felt this sense when I was eating animal foods of kind of a sense of depression and worry and anxiety. And I didn't really know why I felt it, but I think a lot of it comes from just eating. Depression and worry and anxiety and terror and fear and misery and grief. You know, milk and dairy products, eggs and the flesh of these animals, it all has the hormones and the vibrations of misery in it, and it's nothing good in it. I mean, it's going to, ultimately we become sensitive to this, and we just absolutely, I think we'd see that now if I ate it, I'd probably scream. You know?
Well,
I mean, it'd be a sense of, you know, but anyway, that's what I think.
We're just at our last minute here.
Yes. All right.
Thank you for writing this book, The World Peace Diet. I should let people know that there's obviously so much more in the book. I thought you did a really good job of going through the different industries, and in particular for myself, I really appreciated the section where you talked about sea life and oceans and water, because I think so often that is neglected even within the animal communities to talk about those beings as well that suffer through fish, through seafood harvesting, that's in quotes. So I want to let people know that, of course, that you do go through the industry because quite extensively and from this particular perspective. And just to thank you again for being on the program. And I love the section where you talk about that we have the potential to be food for others, positive food for others in our own lives, and that we can enrich other people. And I thought that was a great message.
Right.
Thanks so much, Will.
Great. Thank you, Lauren.
I should let people know, too, if they want to find out more about this book, you can go to www.willtuttle.com. So willtuttle.com to find out more about this book, or you can go to Lantern and order directly through there. Thanks, Will.
Great. Thank you again.
It's been nice to have you on the program.
Thank you. Yeah.
Bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Will, somebody we certainly could have another few programs with, has a lot to say. It's a really extensive book. Check it out if you get the chance. Please stay tuned for Roadrunner. And thanks to Carl Orzechowski for teching.
No problem.
Bye for now.